Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben. Thanks for joining me for my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Welcome to episode 61, for which my guest is the esteemed British photographer Brian Griffin. Before I introduce Brian, a couple of items of housekeeping as usual. If you enjoy and would like to support the ongoing production of this podcast, you can make a one-off donation or sign up for a small recurring monthly payment at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Please subscribe and leave a review on iTunes if you haven't already done that. And if you are in need of a new website but don't have the time or inclination to do it yourself, I can do that for you using the excellent Squarespace platform. Just let me know. Also this week, not for nothing, but it's A Small Voice's second birthday. Yes, indeed. Thank you very much. Yes, thank you. Okay, that's enough of that. So this week I'm delighted to welcome as my guest Brian Griffin. Brian was born in Birmingham in 1948 and grew up in the neighbouring Black Country in the English Midlands. He started his working life at 16, working in a factory where he remained for 5 years, before finally making his escape to Manchester Polytechnic, where he took a degree in photography. Shortly after which he left for London in pursuit of a photographic career as a fashion photographer, and it was there that he met and was mentored by Roland Schenck, the charismatic art director on Management Today magazine, who offered him a job as a corporate photographer. The rest, as they say, is history. Brian was later considered the photographer of the decade by the Guardian newspaper in 1989, the most unpredictable and influential British portrait photographer of the last decades by the British Journal of Photography in 2005, and one of Britain's most influential photographers by the World Photography Organisation in 2015. In 1991, his book Work was awarded the best photography book in the world, a prize at the Barcelona Primavera Photographica. Brian is patron of the Format Photography Festival in Derby. In September 2013, he received the Centenary Medal from the Royal Photographic Society in recognition of a lifetime's achievement in photography. In 2014, he received an honorary doctorate from Birmingham City University. Brian Griffin's photographs are held in the permanent collections of many major art institutions, and he has published 20 or so books, including his latest, Pop, which features some of the highlights of his album artwork and band photography from decades working in the music industry with such artists as Iggy Pop, Elvis Costello, Depeche Mode and Kate Bush. In other words, he's a bit of a legend. I went down to see Brian at his place in Rotherhithe overlooking the River Thames, and he was a total pro despite the fact he'd just returned from China with a terrible bug. He was not a well man that day at all, as you will hear, and I've removed as much of the coughing as I could, but some of it I had no choice but to keep in. And I'm sure you'll agree that none of that can detract from what was a fascinating chat with the one and only Brian Griffin. And you just funded your book. Congratulations on that. That was something you're doing via Kickstarter, like a lot of people are doing now. And I think you needed 30 grand, so it was quite a decent chunk of change you were looking for. But that's now fully funded and that's going to go ahead, right?
Correct.
And that is a book called Pop, which is basically a collection of your album cover stuff that you've done over the years. Is that right?
Yeah, and like press, publicity for bands, all set up stuff. Nothing live, nothing, you know, clicked in the street, nothing like that. Mm. All set up photography.
Yeah.
I was one of the few, you know, who did set up photography
at
that time. Goodness knows why.
Well, that's always what you've done, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I did a lot. I mean, like, people just wanted me. It was really incredible.
Well, I wanted to get into sort of how that all came about in a way, but maybe we should sort of go back to the beginning and then kind of work forward. But where are you with the book at this stage then, now that the funding's sort of completed?
We've edited all the material. We basically laid all the photographs out in a very basic sense, chronologically. Obviously, changes will be made because there is plenty of time to make changes. Then we have all the people that I worked alongside with, like my assistants and things, and my studio down here in Rotherhithe as a section. And then we have another section on people who are in the music industry, everybody from George Martin, producer of the Beatles, to John Peel, the DJ, to Vivian Westwood. As you know, they're designer of most of punk clothing. Then we have another section on the history of this area and what it was like back then. From someone who lived here, someone who knew me well and knew what I was shooting and knew what I did, because he's a music writer, essentially, just by a sheer fluke. He lived up the street.
Who's that?
Terry Rawlings, uh-huh. His name is. And he's written a piece on Rotherhithe, and it was a pretty dark, foreboding area of the early 80s, I'll tell you now. And he's written a great piece on that. Paul Gorman's written a piece for the book. Paul Gorman wrote a book called Reasons to be Cheerful, The Life and Works of Barney Bubbles. Barney and I were very close. We were almost like brothers in a way. And we worked on projects together, both music projects and art projects. Like he designed my Power book. He designed my Copyright 1978 book. He designed my newspaper, Why. And those three arty sort of things. But we did album covers together and singles together. And there's quite a bit Paul's written about my relationship with Barney, which okay. is very strong and very intimate in the sense that it was brotherly love, really.
Mm.
So that's a very moving piece. And then you've got another piece, actually, which really is a piece that runs totally through the book. Terry Rawlings, once again, who's written about what Rotherhithe was like in the 80s, has also done a Q&A all through the book, the music section. He's very knowledgeable on that part of music history. He's a good friend of mine. I mean, the book is really, really rock and roll when it comes to the rapport we have together. It doesn't pull any of the stops, you know. We speak of the bands how we see them, you know, if we love them or hate them or think they're terrible, whatever. It's like really, he's all the way through the book that. So you can get an idea that it's quite a comprehensive book.
Yeah, I was going to say, it sounds very broad ranging, yeah. and you know, it's got a lot of different aspects to it. And who do you think's going to buy the thing? Is it going to be fairly kind of mainstream, or is it a bit more of a kind of specialist audience, do you think?
Very interesting question, for two reasons. One, this book has been floating around all this century, basically. Got a little bit down the road and then not carried on any further. It's had about two full starts over the last 15 years. But now it's actually going ahead. It's interesting, your question, because a lot of people have bought this book already, because as you know, it's a crowdfunded book at the moment. I think something like 400 people have bought it, and it's not even on the shelves yet.
It bodes well for the future.
I mean, obviously a lot of people of my age group who were in the music industry are going to be fascinated by it.
Yeah, and anyone really who was into music during the early 80s, end
of the 70s are going to be into it. I think all the bands will buy it. So they'll be proud of, hopefully, being featured in the book. Then it's the fans. There's some massive bands in the book. Like, obviously, I have to point a finger at Depeche Mode, who've got a massive fan base. And coupled with Iggy Pop, coupled with Elvis Costello, coupled with Echo and the Bunnymen, coupled with Kate Bush. I mean, this is a big fan base that probably will purchase the book. The book itself is a delightful object. It's a book that's worth far more money than people will pay for it. It's about a £50 book. It's going to be retail for £35. We were hoping that we'd sell so many that we could print a lot and bring the unit price down,
yeah,
which I think we'll be able to. Then, of course, you'll be surprised at how many young people are fascinated in the history of music, and all the fashionistas, all the people interested in fashion. You know, the whole book is a fashion document of the late 70s, early 80s. So all the trousers the bands wore, all the ties, all the shirts, all the tops, whatever, all the shoes. It's a fashion book as well. You know, it's got so many photographs in it. It's got well over 1,000 photographs in it.
Really?
Well over 1,000.
That's incredible.
Well over. It's about 500 pages, this book.
Oh, my gosh. So massive. It's a real tome.
Oh, it's a real tome.
So that represents incredible value for money, then, if you're going to be able to sell it for 35 quid. What's interesting to me is that, you know, self-publishing has become a very sort of almost the default way to go these days. It's a very kind of fashionable thing. But you've always done that. At a time when that wasn't even a thing, kind of. How were things done back in the day? Because presumably it wasn't something that many people were doing, or was it?
Nobody was doing it. I mean, there was no photo books around. I mean, we were starting to get quite a few books coming over from America of the stars like Frank, Winogrand, Friedlander, all those sort of Meyerowitz, all those American stars of the 50s, 60s, and early 70s. They were coming over with book. Their books were coming. But here in England, we had Cecil Beaton, Bill Brandt, might have had Angus McBain. I had bookshelves of British photography, if we were trying to fill out bookshelves of British photography. It was non-existent. When I was at art college, there was like nothing. It was BJ Annual, there was Photography Annual, Creative Camera Annual, and one or two others. I think I was rather egotistical, and I think I was extreme. I've always been a very confident guy. I don't know where it comes from.
Really?
I have no idea where it comes from, but I have, and I had the confidence of doing it when I didn't have any money in the late 70s. I mean, I was an editorial photographer existing on £25, £30, £35 jobs. I did quite a few of them, but I was determined to publish, and I've spoken to Martin Parr about this book, Brian Griffin, copyright 1978. And he said it's probably the first ever in our lifetime self-published photographic book. When I brought it out, Barney Bubbles designed it. No one bought it.
Right.
In fact, I've got a history of that. In fact, this is the first book, this music book's first type book that anybody's decided to buy, really.
Mm.
My workbook, which is quite a famous book now, which came another 10 years later, no one bought that either. Why, which came 5 years later, the newspaper for an exhibition at the Photographer's Gallery, no one bought that either. I still possess this idea that no one's going to be interested in anything I do.
Right.
It's so ingrained in me, because I've had such a lack of interest in most things I've done. I've had a lot of admiration. My career has received a lot of admiration, but it hasn't received like categorical purchases or, you know, buying my books or things like that. Not that much of that in that area that would sustain me.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's been a combination of, you know, The Guardian said you were the most important photographer of the decade in the 80s, or at the end of the 80s, I think. So clearly there's been a certain amount of recognition, but maybe for whatever reason, not quite as much as you warrant, I would suggest
that you're correct with that.
Yeah. But you weren't deterred by the lack of sales. It was almost as though you were making the books for yourself. Is that pretty much
true?
I
remember when Copyright 1978, which is the first book we've been talking about, and was my first book, I remember being in bed actually, and arriving in the post like one copy or something. And the first thing I did was smell it. I always smell a new book. It's a fantastic experience to smell a new book. And I remember lying in bed smelling Copyright. It was fabulous, and I didn't give a damn if it sold, which it didn't sell. It didn't sell at all, which is just the reverse now. I mean, I could sell every single one that ever went out on the street, really.
Yeah, of course.
But it has taken, how many years is that? 37,
yeah,
30,
several decades.
Years, yeah.
But I guess, like a lot of artists, that's kind of a pattern that's always been with us from the year dot, which is that you don't necessarily get recognition at the time you're doing it. It sometimes comes later.
Yeah.
So there was never really any chance of earning money out of those self-published projects then.
No, never. It was frightening at times. I mean, when Peter Davenport, who designed the workbook in 88.
And this book was, I should sort of mention to the listeners who aren't familiar with it, was hailed as the most important
photographic book in the world, yeah.
Ever. Which must have Barcelona felt pretty
incredible.
Good.
But it only sold one. I had a party. I mean, I was doing a lot of commercial work in the 80s. I was quite wealthy. And I had a party to launch it. I invited 800 people that I knew to this party. I didn't have to pay for the space. The bands played for nothing. Everyone had to buy their own beer and alcohol. I supplied them with a veggie burger or a meat burger, whichever they wanted, all 800 of them. And I had like a hatch, serving hatch in this studio, from the kitchen within the studio, with all the books lined up, the hardbacks and the softbacks. So I printed 1,000 hardbacks, 2,000 softbacks. One sold. 800 people came to the launch of it, and one sold. So, like, when I did Why, the newspaper in 83, one sold. And I met the guy who bought it, actually, in New York last year. And when I did Copyright 1978, one sold. So I've been indoctrinated with publishing failures, really, back then. So I've been able to accept lack of recognition, not necessarily lack of recognition, because I've had a lot of recognition, but lack of people really interested in supporting the work I do.
I don't know if it's necessarily even that unusual. I mean, it is a very tough thing to sell, you know, a 40 quid photo book. And I guess the good thing about the current model is you're kind of market testing from the start, really, because people are actually, essentially, they're buying the thing before it exists. So in a way, you're taking that uncertainty out of the equation. You know, if you fund your book, then some people have already bought it by definition. Let's go back to the beginning and then kind of work forward again. You grew up in the Black Country in the Midlands. Yeah. And what was that like in the sort of 50s and 60s? Was it pretty beaten down after the war and all that?
Yeah, I mean, the war was ever present in terms of the paraphernalia from it. You know, all the delivery wagons, whether they were bread or whether they were coal or whether they were lemonade or tires or whatever, were army trucks. The working men in the factories tended to wear the great coats to come home, you know, the military great coats. A lot of them actually had the military berets as well as a form of headwear. And it was constantly on the television, the Second World War, little black and white things. It was ever present, in certainly up, you know, through the early 50s.
Right.
It was incredibly polluted, incredibly. We didn't seem to care because we'd been born into it, so we thought that was natural, what it was like. But, I mean, I think if people could just look at what we played in, where we played, as children that is, and what we breathed in, they would not be able to believe it.
Mm.
It was so polluted. It was full of mines, it was full of factories, it was full of steelworks, it was full of brickworks, which is brickwork smoke is really arid. And that was like literally the brickworks was 200 yards maximum from my home. All the music which has inspired me over the years emanated from the factories. There would either be lightly bashing baths or handles on buckets or, you know, enamel buckets and things, galvanized buckets, which are very trendy now. You could smell galvanizing because it was all over the streets, you know, bucket and bath works. And all the smells you had. And then you had the techno. You had the hammers working, the big, massive tonnage, you know, of the big hammer coming down and stamping things at the stamping work. So I grew into loving electronic music is because the music was...
You can see why that is.
It was techno every day of my life. All surrounding my playground at junior school was a factory wall. It was, in fact, the side of the factory building. And it was a bucket in bath works where you heard people tapping all day, you know, when you have to get the handle round and tap it around so it, like, you know what I mean, at the top. All you heard was tapping.
So there was this sort of percussion soundtrack going on the whole time.
And I've loved electronic music all my life, really.
And then you kind of started working in those kind of environments when you were very young as well. You were, I don't know what, sort of 16 or something.
16.
Which was probably fairly common at that place at that time to leave school and start work. But did it seem to you that that was something that you, you know, a fate that you needed to escape eventually?
I was horrified. I mean, I suffered heavily with hay fever, like really bad. I couldn't even virtually open my eyes, and I was constantly sneezing and sniffling. When I did my O-levels, you know, I was just totally unfit to sit my exams. I had the maximum amount of O-levels in my school. I was given the opportunity of getting 9 O-levels, but I failed most of them. I just couldn't concentrate.
Mm.
So I wanted to stay on into the sixth form and retake them, especially, say, in the winter when the hay fever wasn't around and I could gather them and then get my A-levels when I was 18, second year of the seventh form, in other words, sixth, seventh form. And then all of a sudden my parents said, you've got to leave. I said, what? They said, you've got to leave, you've got to get in the factory because we need the money.
Right.
They forced me to leave. I was horrified. I've got to go in the factory. I didn't want to go there.
Hmm.
I was a bright young boy. Okay, I hadn't done very well in my O-levels because I couldn't even concentrate on them. But I didn't want to go in a factory. It's hell.
So
I had to. Yeah. I had no choice. So therefore, I didn't have enough O-levels to when I went, obviously, I went on part-time day release, you know, engineering, ordinary national certificate, higher national certificate, which are like degrees in mechanical engineering type of thing.
Huh.
But of course, I had to start even lower than that because I'd failed my O-levels and I didn't have enough O-levels to start well up the tree. So I went right down to the basic. So I like spent 5 years, maybe a good 5 years in the factory.
That must have almost killed you. I mean,
I didn't want to do that at all.
How did you survive?
I mean, obviously stubbornness, and I had a girlfriend that I was in love with, which helped. I had a discotheque. Me and my mate had a discotheque that we did once a week, playing progressive music as it was then. If you remember all those progressive bands, like anything from Captain Beefheart to Grateful Dead, you know,
right.
Pink Floyd, yeah. All those bands. We had a disco for that.
You had a life outside of work, which sort of
which compensated.
Kept you. Yeah.
And I was in love with this woman who eventually I moved to work in the office as an estimating engineer. But prior to moving into the office when I was about 20, I was down in the factory one day and the foreman of the factory said, have you ever been interested in photography? And I said, no, I haven't really. He said, I think you'd be quite good at it. And he introduced me to the local camera club. And then obviously I gained an interest in photography, although it was very, very marginal interest. I wasn't obsessed with it, really. I was just marginally interested in it. So I had that interest as well, which then I could employ when I was almost 22 to get to art college, you know. But I had to sit my O-levels again to get to art college.
You went to university. You went to Polytechnic.
Yeah, I went to Polytechnic.
And did that seem like that was your escape plan, as it were?
Well, I was devastated. A girl called Sandy Black, who I was madly in love with, left me for somebody else. And I just couldn't stand it, life back in the black country anymore. So I resat my O-levels, because you needed 5, of which one must be maths and one English, I think. I can't remember now, which I got. And Manchester accepted me. Mm. They accepted me because they were blooming desperate, actually, to be honest. exactly, yeah. And so I left the black country in 69. And we went to Manchester Poly.
Had you at that stage already sort of got quite serious about the photography, or did you start really realising that it was something you might want to pursue in the course of doing that degree?
I thought, well, I was told my mum and dad that I'm going to be the greatest photographer on earth type of thing, which they laughed and joked about. I didn't believe it either.
Yeah.
But I had to say something, you know, because they were devastated me leaving my job as an estimating engineer on nuclear power station pipework. Quite a sort of sophisticated job, really, when they were building nuclear power stations in the late 60s, early 70s. And I went to college, and I've always had a slight misgivings about my ability. The first misgiving was, oops, have I landed myself in a real wrong place here, you know, when the first day at college. And our first thing that we asked to do, probably every first year asked to, was photograph an egg. So photographed an egg in the studio. And the students were, and the staff were mind blown with my egg picture. And I went, oh, thank God for that. Looks like I might be okay at this photography lark.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't totally full of confidence about it.
Mm. Was it? Did it tend to be a kind of technical course? I mean, was it all about, you know, becoming a technician, as it were? Or was it? Was there more of an arty angle to it as well?
It was more of an arty angle, although you had to do artistry and you had to do sensitometry. You had to do the sciences and the physics of photography.
Oh, right, okay.
Which a few people who were brilliant at photography actually were kicked out because they were no good mathematically, technically, or whatever. Well, they were great artistically, and they were. I was deeply shocked.
Hmm.
But it fell into, when we're talking about analog world here, by the way, because we're talking now some 69 to 72. Because I'd got all that mathematical knowledge, it worked in my favour. I was like brilliant in mathematics because it had been my job. I'm not saying I am particularly brilliant in mathematics, but it had been my job, so I was brilliant in mathematics. And I was captain. I was captain of the chess team at school. I was a school captain, so that also kept me in good stead because, i.e., the mathematics in the analog days, especially some of my complex ways of going about things in the 80s, that really played a major part. And regarding my chess ability, it helped me with my portraiture, that I could con my subject into doing what I wanted them to do.
Right, so it was the psychological advantage.
Fallen, like, when I'd fallen into, like, oh my God, I got to go in the factory in 64. In 69, I'd fallen on my feet, you know, both because I was good at chess and I was good at maths. So both of those feeding into my career eventually as a photographer just put me leagues ahead of a lot of people.
So ultimately, I suppose that is the kind of silver lining in all that.
Yeah.
You know, there was something good to be derived from that sort of period of
it's
suffering.
It's funny you say that, because everything that appeared to be wrong about how my life progressed during those early years has actually become marvelous, and it's been like I would never have succeeded without it. It's a really weird thing, you know? Because I felt it was the worst thing that could happen to me, but it's actually been the best, certainly during the first 20 years of my career.
It's almost like that stoic kind of philosophy that, you know, you're really figuring out how to change seeming disadvantages into advantages. You're working with what you've got, and that's kind of what you've done in a way. But then you kind of hightailed it over to down to London. Was that because, you know, that's where you thought the best chance of earning some money was after you'd finished the course?
That was the reason, yeah.
That was where it was all happening.
I hadn't got any money, though. Although in today's world, as a student leaving his polytechnic course, university course, I wasn't saddled with like a £30,000 debt or anything. I was saddled with something like about £120 debt.
Yeah.
Which £120 probably in 72 is probably 300 or 400 now at least.
Yeah.
So obviously I was a little bit concerned about it. I'd taken myself down to London because I thought I was going to be a top fashion photographer. So I visited a lot of magazines, slept on my friends' couches at their parents' houses, and come back and then worked in the steelwork. A horrible job. This is even worse than the factory I went to. It's a big steelwork that overlooked where I lived.
So you returned to the Midlands?
Yeah, to work in the steelwork, to raise money to go back to London.
Right, because you couldn't actually...
I couldn't afford to be in London without raising a few hundred pounds. It was a horrible job. It was replacing the chains on top of the big gantry cranes that run over the top of the furnaces and things, you know. Yeah. So it was really horrible and dusty and polluted. Because you have to remember, you know, no health and safety existed in those days.
Yeah.
No one wore a mask. No one wore high vis. It was nothing.
Right.
It was really dangerous up on those overhead cranes and stuff in the top of a steelwork.
So that must have made, you know, a career in photography seem all the more attractive.
Absolutely.
To try and get out of that and back to taking pictures for a living.
So I earned some money at this steelwork called Round Oak Steelworks, which I would later photograph the outside of it. For Depeche Mode's fourth album some great reward, because they were turned it eventually into a shopping centre in the early 80s, big shopping centre. So I actually got this still work that I actually worked in on the front cover of Depeche Mode album. And I was so rich. I mean, growing up in the Black Country, I was so full of imagery. One, it's got a strange sense of humour, the Black Country. I mean, I know that lots of photographers go there now, whether it's Bruce Gilden or Susan Marsalis or Martin Parr or Mark Power. But they're onlookers, you know what I mean? They're looking outside, you know, in. And they never be able to photograph it. It's not possible. You can photograph it superficially, but you can't photograph it with any truth attached to it, because there's a great sense of weird, really weird humour, which I employ all through my career in all my work.
Right.
It's very dry, very visual.
So you think you've got to be on the inside in order to sort of really properly get that?
Yeah, you've got to be brought up there. And obviously Richard Billingham was as well. You know, he was born just literally a mile and a half from me. He did a great book on his parents, as you know, full well. Yeah,
Ready to Laugh.
Yeah, and I think only me and Richard have really photographed it, or certainly made books about it that have got any substance. You can't bring, you know, upper middle class and middle class photographers into the Black Country. It doesn't gel. The Black Country's got no middle class or upper middle class in it, hardly. It's a different stream of society.
Yeah. And also, you know, this kind of industrial landscape that you grew up in must have had an influence on, you know, what became a sort of running theme, which was that you photograph workers for most of your career on and off. Is that where that interest comes from?
That's where it came from. I mean, it basically came from because of the treatment of the workers by the bosses. I didn't like it. Like, my dad was a very top machinist. He was a horizontal borer, which, like, really, if there's a big hole in something, it, like, makes the hole perfect in whatever shape it is, like, bores it out to be perfect. And he was very highly paid for a factory worker. And I saw how subservient he was, you know, to the bosses who came to steal him from a factory he was working in to work for them or whatever, because he was one of the best in the area. And I didn't like to see my dad all humble.
Mm.
I just didn't like it. And when I went in the factories, because also we have to remember, I grew up amongst them. They were down my street, they were down the next street. There were foundries, there were steelworks, you know, all the big hot steel, you know, rolling mills, you know. They were all around with all the fumes coming up, men grabbing the hot steel and throwing it through the rolling mills. I mean, I grew up with these men with their singlets on, all dirty, you know, and in terrible conditions. And I saw the bosses, you know, which lived in big houses. And it really instilled on me. I was almost a communist, actually.
Right, right.
The early 70s, I got very close. It was so horrible how they treated the workers up in the, you know.
So you never wanted to, you know, have that same kind of subservience to, you know, the upper classes be part of your kind of, you know, landscape. You had a certain kind of pride or something that you didn't want to be treated that way. Where did that come from?
Interesting. That's probably the most brilliant question of the whole event so far. It certainly came from somewhere, because there have been comments from people I worked with on Facebook, etc., where I never followed their direction. You know, I always made my own direction. If it was a big advertising campaign, there was an editorial job, whatever it was, I did my own thing. I was determined from day one that I would always plough my own unique furrow, really, and never fall into the trap of earning loads of money by applying myself to what they desired.
Mm.
So I'd be like any other photographer. I decided I wasn't never going to do that. It served me well initially. It served me well in the sense I was really highly paid in the 80s, really highly paid. It served me well.
Yeah, because you've pulled off a difficult trick there, because, yeah, you've managed to be commercially successful, but also to remain kind of creatively independent.
Well, I'm surviving now because of that. You know, young students and young photographers, if they start to give way and start to abide. They'll never be able to earn anything from their profession of, as a photographer when they're older. So no one's going to desire it. You know, it's all going to be come to run stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm surviving or certainly earning some money from my old stuff, very much so. And I'm glad, but also I have to make a point here. I haven't mentioned it, but it's probably quite obvious. I was an only child. So I had to make my own playthings. I had to make my own games. You know, when it was raining outside, I couldn't play with my friends. Or I had to entertain myself.
Right. So you developed an imagination, as
it were. Yeah, imagination, yeah. And I thought, I always thought my imagination was better than anybody's that I worked with. It wasn't, of course. Of course it wasn't, I can possibly say that. But I had that instilled in my brain that it was. And I was like quite confident in like ploughing my own furrow, you know.
And you were into art, were you, when you were young? Were you sort of painter or drawer?
I was, yeah. I was one of the best at my grammar school, my stroke technical school. I was one of the best. I could have gone into painting.
Mm.
I'm really odd. I give up things, actually, that sometimes I should have pursued.
Well, you haven't given up photography, that's for sure.
I gave up chess, you know, because I was beating everybody I knew.
Right.
You know, anybody who played chess, I could beat them, apart from people who were really good at it, because I was the captain of the grammar school. I was playing in the West Midland Championships, and I couldn't play anybody, and I was scared to beat people. I didn't like it, so I stopped playing people.
So you would have had to actively seek out better players to sort of challenge yourself.
So I haven't really played since 1964.
Right.
So I probably crap now.
It's never too late, Brian. You could have a game tomorrow if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny, we're talking about this thing of ploughing your own furrow, and I'm wondering whether you think it's sort of more so than ever the case in that, you know, because we now have digital technology and anyone can take a picture, which is a theme that is continually on the agenda, I think, in photography, that, you know, the only real way to differentiate yourself is by having your own vision. You know, that there was a time when as a photographer you were hired as a sort of technician, as someone who could produce this sort of alchemy whereby, you know, something that no one knows what it looks like is going to actually end up looking awesome. But now everyone knows what it bloody looks like as soon as it's taken. So I'm wondering whether you think that, in a way, it's more important than ever to have a kind of personal vision, even in the commercial world.
Most definitely. It seems really, really barren in that sense that most of photography is mostly homogenous. Like everybody looks like everybody else, and you have to ask who did that, you know. Whilst back in the 70s, probably everyone looked a bit different. It was analog, obviously, so they printed differently. And they approach their photography different in a very dynamic, different ways. Now everyone seems to look the same.
Mm.
There is a lot of reasons for that. Is because if you point, it will come out, you know, which we could never point the camera at something and hope it would come out, because it probably wouldn't.
Yeah.
Unless you applied some method that you've developed yourself to ensure it gets exposed properly and all the information's there. Whilst now, I mean, you just point it and the computer gets it perfect. I'm seeing a real drop-off of quality photography. Photography is almost like impossible to take a great photograph. It's almost the definition of impossibility. It's like so difficult. So they don't happen very often. When me and Martin started in the 70s, going our own ways.
Martin Parr?
Yeah.
Mm.
We used to, at the end of each year, say how many gems, we call them gems. How many gems did you get this year? And we were brutally honest with each other, because that's the only way it would make any sense. And then sometimes we didn't get any, or we only got one. Sometimes we might get three through the whole year.
Yeah.
And now we're talking about Martin's famous work through the 70s, you know, some of his chapels and all that stuff, where he would disregard it as being a gem. Because I never ever heard him say more than one or two, which he obviously had more than one or two. That's how stringent we were, really, and how determined we were to take great photographs. We were absolutely determined. Laziness never played a part. we knew that was the disease, you know, if that came in. But the problem is with modern technology, it's easy to get this disease like permeating through you totally, and you end up with average stuff.
Mm.
That seems to be what's happening. I look back now at all the photographers that are younger than me, I see a lot of photography. I go to festivals. I'm a part of the Format Festival, a patron there. It's a bit desperate, really, I think.
I guess it's always been the case in a way. You know, the good stuff, you know, it only represents a very small percentage of the total. But there's definitely some great young people out there, especially in the documentary arena and sort of the kind of area where that meets a slightly more artistic approach. You developed a very specific thing for yourself in a way. You know, with your portraits, it was this kind of incredibly distinctive aesthetic, really. Often there was a prop involved. It was very considered. It was very, almost very collaborative, I guess you'd say. It's not like the people, you know, was just like standing there, right? There was always some element of performance to it.
Yeah. I always respected the subject.
And I think your influences maybe a painting and other art forms.
They are. I don't look at photography for inspiration. I never have.
Yeah,
I have knowledge of it, obviously I need to have an understanding of my medium I'm working in.
Yeah.
But it's not my inspiration.
No.
Painting is just painting.
How did that kind of approach that you've taken and kind of continue to work with come about in a way? Can you point to any particular...
Working with Roland Schenk on Management Today.
Right.
He was from Switzerland. He'd been the art director of Du magazine. He'd come over to be a tutor at Norwich School of Art as a painting tutor. His painting was very similar to Oskar Kokoschka's, who was an Austrian expressionist. And he played a leading part in my development.
He was your kind of mentor in a way, mentor.
Yeah, he was my mentor. He drove me. He was very brutal. He was absolutely brutal. I mean, he didn't, he just gave you it. Like, he didn't hold back whatsoever.
Tough love.
Yeah. And I've tried that, the same method I grew up with when I've taught at universities and got the sack.
Right, really?
When I've said, you're a useless photographer. You're useless. You're wasting your money. Just leave, you know.
Right.
Or, look, I've told you how to do that. You know, I've told you how to take a light meter reading. Why can't you do it? You know, like, really brutal. And get the sack. But I had that brutality with Roland Schenk, and he really beat me into shape. He inspired me. He got me looking at German Expressionism in the early 70s, basically the cinema of Lang, Murnau, Pabst, Dreyer, German Expressionist filmmaking of the late teens, i.e. before 1920 and post-1920. He got me into that, and he got me into Expressionism as an art movement, where I started to learn how to externalize how I felt about somebody, to externalize my feelings from the subject, is where the subject is not bestowing upon you their feelings. The subject, in combination to how you photographed them and where you photographed them, gives an overall picture on how you feel about them. Now, I learned that from Expressionism. And then I developed up into Russian constructivism, and also into social realism, both in Germany and Russia. It started to get me on a development. Then I started to get involved with the Belgian symbolists of the 19th century, who basically were inspired by literature. I started to really look at them as painters. And he had launched me, you know, into a new way of being inspired.
Right. So although he was tough, he was clearly, you know, instrumental and encouraging in his own way, I guess, you know. And it's funny that you were really, you know, working on a magazine title that you would not expect to receive that kind of, you know, inspirational training on Management Today. So that kind of took you back into back to London and back to working. And then from there you kind of developed, you know, a career as a commercial photographer or editorial slash commercial. What was the next big kind of break, as it were?
Well, for the first year, I was pretty come to run as a photographer. I wasn't good enough to really make a difference with my photographs. But then it gradually came around, right about 74. I was like messing around a bit. I mean, I was a bit Arnold Newman-esque. I was a bit here, a bit there. I didn't have any true focus. And then about 74, I started to get it, where I realized that, carrying on what I said earlier about expressionism, I realized that all these businessmen were actors. That's how I put it in my head. And their environments, i.e. their offices, was the stage. So all I've got to do is get my actor to react and to act on the stage. And it was easy after that. I found the solution to it.
Yeah.
So then I just marched on, really, and I took a great picture in 74. I always say that to my assistants. I said, if you want to be a world-class photographer, you've got to take a great picture within 2 years. World-class picture. And that was through the back of the taxi, you know, the people going across London Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
And I breathed a big sigh. Because, as you know, it's only 18 months after leaving art college, or 2 years maximum. I breathed a sigh of relief. Oh, God, I'm going to make it.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
I think you've said, because it was, you know, was, I think a lot of people these days think of those times as a sort of almost a golden age for photography, and that, you know, it was possible to, you know, it was probably quite glamorous and, you know, kind of post David Bailey and all very sexy and everything. But you've said that actually it was very difficult even then to earn a living doing it.
Oh, the competition was fierce. What I would like to say, though, is that the talent within the magazine world, and eventually as I got into the world of corporate photography, and we worked on management today, in the 80s, got into corporate photography. There were some great talents, both in marketing in the corporate world and picture editing in the editorial world. I mean, really, like, really talented people that were easily as good as I was as a photographer, as a picture editor, as a marketing director. They were easily as clever as me, if not better in some cases. So it was a very good environment that I was roaming around in. The 70s, editorially, the magazines I worked on, and in the 80s, the annual reports that I worked on.
So when the sort of 80s Thatcherite kind of boom time came, you were quite well placed to take advantage of that, in the sense that you'd cut your teeth as a corporate guy, so you were one of the sort of people to go to. Is that more or less the case?
That's very much the case. Again, it's the same as we've been talking about mostly through this discussion, whereby sheer luck, I landed on my feet.
Yeah. Like, well, you make your own luck, though, I believe, anyway.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wanted to be a fashion photographer. I ended up working photographing portraits of businessmen, you know, which was pretty low brow in the 70s. It wasn't, if you said, well, I do portraits of businessmen, they'd go, oh.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I think it's probably still thought. Yeah. You know, in that way.
And so it was by sheer fortune that Maggie came into power, in my case. Obviously not politically, by any stretch of the I'm not talking about politics here. I'm talking about how the world of this country changed in 79 and fell into my hands. You know, if someone had a very pressurized big corporate job to do, I was the man with experience. You know, I'd done 8 years, 7 or 8 years of it. I knew how to handle these executives. And I must say, if it was in any way, even slightly in engineering, then I could talk to them, because I was still, I'd left in 69 engineering, so I still had a certain amount of knowledge even through the 70s.
Right.
Now I couldn't talk to them, of course.
Yeah.
But then I could, and they'd be quite impressed about it.
Yeah, kind of, as we were saying, you're kind of just using what you've got. I guess, you know, when you go to photograph a person as a photographer, you have to do that. You know, you have to, any kind of connection that you can make, you know, no matter how tenuous, is something that I think we all probably do, you know, to try and try and develop some kind of a relationship, even albeit kind of superficial.
I mean, I thought of loads of cons, actually, in order to get a person to do it. You know, I utilized my chess knowledge in the sense of, like, opening up and demonstrating failure or demonstrated inadequacy. You know, I played on the psychology of the subjects in all sorts of ways to get my own way.
And you're getting people who aren't used to performing in any way to be quite, you know, sort of, you know, these are kind of very straight suit people, you know, from the corporate world, and you're getting them to do stuff that probably feels very kind of alien to them and, you know, quite uncomfortable. It's not like they're actors or something who thrive on that kind of stuff. What was the kind of reactions that you got from people when you said, look, I, you know, what you, it, you know, when they realized what your approach was?
Well, I had a bit of help eventually when I got into the 80s, where I started to be able to have assistance, and I started to have lights and things and Hasselblads and that.
Mm.
I developed all the way from Olympus OM-1 with a couple of lenses through to Hasselblad with flash equipment, everything, and a studio down here in Rotherhithe from 1980, May 80. And so therefore I always asked my subjects to give me an hour to set up, you know, like I'd speak to their secretaries, whatever, and try and get in an hour before my programmed time with the subject so I could look around. And so the subject would come into another room, not their office, because I didn't want to set up in their offices a lot of the time, because, I mean, it would be uncomfortable both for them, and maybe it was a place I didn't want to work in anyway. But, and then I would set my lights up, Hasselblad and tripod assistants, Polaroids, everything. And of course, they'd walk into this environment and they'd be blown away. They expected some guy handheld, you know what I mean,
clicking
away with a flash on top of the camera or something. I don't know what.
Yeah, so they realised they were sort of walking into something a bit different.
A bit different. From there. This is special. So I had them in my hand. You know, I had them in my hand.
Uh-huh.
I used every method I could think of in order to absolutely override and control the subject. And I mean, it was so essential.
Yeah.
But I tried all sorts of methods. All sorts of methods to get on top of the subject.
Yeah.
And I'm sure I'm not the only one. I'm sure portrait photographers of the past have all done that.
Yeah, of course, I guess.
But that was how I did it.
Yeah. Yeah, so as a guy who, you know, almost became a communist, you were clearly you were obviously no fan of Maggie's. But you photographed her. What was she like to photograph?
Wonderful.
Really?
I heard David Bailey say the same thing when he had his show at the National Portrait Gallery a couple of years ago. Say the same thing.
But she's a wonderful subject.
Oh, yeah.
Because why? Because she knows what she's doing.
She's so confident.
Mm.
So confident within herself.
I hope the youngsters actually know who the hell we're talking about. This is what goes back to what we were talking about earlier about musical references. There's also these political references. You know, I mean, I don't. I'm sure people know what Thatcherism was and who she was. But yeah, sorry, carry on, Brian.
Yeah, we did it in number 10 Downing Street, where I couldn't believe I could get into number 10 because I was in CND for a start,
right.
Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament.
Yeah, yeah.
Which was still the Cold War.
A lot of us were.
I got A class, you know. I mean, we walked up, me and my two assistants, parked my Range Rover outside number 10. Policeman was at the door and let us in with all our lights and everything. I mean, you can never do that now, really.
No.
So easily. But she was really, really confident, and I got to trick her as well, you know.
Mm.
Because she was going to open a part of Broadgate. One of the, what can you call it, the stages or one of the schemes there, one of the big buildings there, she was going to come and the property developers had commissioned me to do a portrait of her to put into the brochure. So I went there, but she had to wear a hard hat, you know what I mean, because appropriator in a way. And we put three... I think it was three, red, four hard hats, like that game of shells where you put the pea in the shell and you keep on moving around and try and figure out where the shell is, the pea is, on this green base table in number 10. And she came in and she said, well, how do you want me? They always said that. They always say that. Everybody does. And then you say, oh, well, Prime Minister, we'd like you to wear a hard hat. I said, fine. She went over to the table and picked the blue one, obviously, because it's conservative blue. In that day, it was analog, and I never really enjoyed photographing anything in colour film. Roland Schenker told me I was the worst colour photographer on earth in the early 70s. And it ingrained in me, and I hated shooting colour. But I did, because they wanted colour. And then you would give it a lab who would then do internegs and produce black and white neg, you know, for printing from the colour tranny. Right. So we always shot on tranny. Everything was shot on tranny. None of this colour neg. I didn't use colour neg till this century.
Right.
It was all tranny, which is really difficult material.
Yeah, you got to really know what you're doing expose it, right? So.
And she got the blue hat on, and I had to go up to her and get her to take the blue off. So I didn't want a dark, fairly mid-grey to dark grey hat on her. I wanted her to wear a white hat. And I went up to her, and I said, "Prime Minister, that blue helmet with your dress looks just awful." He said, "Oh, does it?" I said, "Yes, Prime Minister, it does. Would you kindly choose a different one?" So she's not going to choose the red one,
of course.
Obviously. She didn't choose the grey, the chrome one, because it's too gauche or something. I don't know why she didn't, but she didn't. She chose the white one, which is the one I wanted her to have. I knew I'd got a good chance of her going for the white
one. Yeah.
And she wore the white one. And then she came. We had to set up our lights prior to her entrance into the room. Big room, actually. And she said, "How do you want me then now?" I said, "I'd like you to dance like Isadora Duncan." Now, Isadora Duncan was strangled by her scarf going into the rear wheel of her open-top car.
Really? That's how she died.
You know, the spokes.
Yeah.
And it just got in the spokes and strangled her as it launched off the car. And she said, "No problem." And she just danced, actually. I said, "Would you dance for me like Isadora Duncan?"
That's incredible. I'm kind of surprised she was up for it. But
she was a wonderful subject. And most of the male politicians I photographed were really tedious and boring.
Mm, mm. And stiff,
Even Anthony Wedgwood Benn was boring as hell. But I got a good picture of him. But he didn't have to do anything.
Well, at the same time, you were developing this musical side to the practice, though. When did all that sort of doing album covers and working with bands start?
Well, I thought laterally about it in a way, like in 78, maybe, or 77, I can't remember.
Yeah.
I saw Elvis Costello and the Attractions wearing suits, ties and shirts.
Yeah.
And the Jam were wearing them in a few other bands. I thought, oh, I can photograph
them. Oh, right, because they were dressed the same. Right.
So I went round to Stiff Records.
So those kind of punk times were...
Post-punk, yeah.
But post-punk, well, 77, 78 was probably right in the middle of it. But did that interest you musically or even photographically?
Photographically, it did. Yeah. No, musically, I wasn't that interested in any of the bands I photographed.
You were into craft work or something?
Yeah, I was into craft work, Can, Noi, all those sort of bands, really. But I quite liked Echo and the Bunnymen, though, and Iggy Pop.
Right, okay. Yeah, so it's quite a broad church in a way. But yeah, so you started shooting these bands, which is where we started the conversation, because that's the kind of material that this new book you've done is kind of drawn from. And did you enjoy working with musicians generally?
Not really. I wasn't very good at photographing groups of people. I only developed an ability to photograph groups of people in the mid-90s. Not the mid-90s, the early part of the 20s, the noughties, like around about when I did St. Pancras, which was around about 2005, 2006.
St. Pancras, which is a big rail station here.
Yeah,
you shot a thing when that was developed.
So, I mean, I didn't photograph the bands very well. I photographed one band quite well, called the Pop Group. That was quite a good one.
But
I wasn't very good.
Well, okay, but you obviously kept getting the gigs, as it were, and you worked a lot with... What was it like working with Costello? He's a bit of a musical hero of mine. Was he good to work with, or was he a pain?
No, he was quite strong. Quite strong-willed, quite brusque, very talented, of course.
Yeah.
Because I worked with him a few times. I did two promos and about three album covers, I think. I met him way back in 78 for Armed Forces in LA. He was a challenge, but he looked good. And he continued to wear suits and that, and basically all through his career, really. So he was good subject matter. Always liked to photograph individuals personally rather than bands.
Yeah.
Bands, they were a real pain, like the drummer never wanted to get in the picture or...
Right, right, yeah, it's just...
They'd all be tripping or something. There was a few bands that come to my studio tripping. I had to tell them to go.
Yeah. I had to tell them which to band leave. Was that?
Well, I'm assuming they were tripping. I didn't actually physically ask them. It would be Talk Talk and Teardrop Explodes.
Okay, right, so real 80s bands.
But they might not have been, but I thought they were.
Yeah.
Because I was as bad, you know, I was... smoking a lot of weed and smoking a lot of cigarettes, drinking a lot of alcohol. I mean, I wasn't pure and
no. Well, it's only rock and roll. It kind of goes hand in hand. You know? But you photographed Iggy Pop. You photographed a lot of the really major players. And Depeche Mode became a bit of a, you know, that particular album cover that you did for them. I think is probably one of your most well known. Which people will, if they don't know what we're talking about, can go and find it on your website or somewhere online. And it will be in the new book, of course. Yeah, and then at some point, you abandoned Stills altogether for a certain amount of time. What led to that decision? Was that a kind of commercial decision?
Being such an egotistical man.
It was an ego-driven decision.
Yeah, I thought I could walk on water. When you think about the end of the 80s, I'd be given, whatever been declared, as you said earlier, the Guardian of the Decade by the Guardian.
The photographer of the decade, yeah.
I'd had a one-man show in Trafalgar Square at the National Portrait Gallery. I'd been given the freedom of the city of Arles.
Right.
And my book, Work, had been voted the best photographic book in the world.
Right. So it's kind of not surprising that
thought I could do anything.
Yeah.
So I thought, why don't I ever go in movie making?
Right.
So I locked all the cameras away in 91, I think, and went into, and because I'd been offered some commercials by Bartle Bogle Hegarty, big commercials actually. They were to be shot in Africa and in the desert of Arizona, and they were big budgets, and half a million each sort of thing.
Right. And you'd never really had any experience doing anything on that level.
Yeah.
And how did it go?
And it was really lovely because all the guys on the shop floor next to me, apart from the producers, which were upper middle class, the producers were all working class, you know, all the Sparks.
The crew, Pips, yeah.
All the crew. And I loved it, the fact that they were all working class I was working with, because photography wasn't full of working class people either. You know, there's quite a lot of middle class and upper middle class people in photography. But I really felt the difference when I went into film and I thought, oh, I like this environment, I feel comfortable.
So you enjoyed that aspect of it?
Yeah.
What were there aspects of it that you didn't enjoy in the way that you enjoyed Stills photography?
Yeah, eventually after the editing process and the post-production process, there'd been nothing resembling your initial idea.
Right.
And I eventually got fed up of it. Obviously I was making loads of money.
Yeah.
Do
you think it's important to sort of go out of your comfort zone, though, and go and do something like that to challenge yourself from time to time? Is that a sort of thing that you would advise people to do?
I would advise people to feel unsteady about what they're doing. I feel unsteady about the projects I'm doing now. I'm not, like, full of confidence about them.
So that feeling never quite goes
never
away?
Never disappears. Never, ever. And you just pray, because you've had that feeling so often, that it'll turn out pretty good, as opposed to turning out truly crap that you think it is at the moment.
Well, I think it's probably encouraging for youngsters to hear you say that, because if they're feeling that now, and they think that they're feeling that because, you know, they're young and inexperienced, then they now know that they're still going to be feeling that way in 40 years if they're lucky enough to be still, shooting in 40 years.
Well, I mean, I spend a far more time now thinking about what I'm going to do than I ever have. I don't rush into anything. I really think really thoroughly about how I'm going to attack something, more than I've ever have done. I mean, I've always been conceptual in a way, but I think it's become even more conceptual these days. And I don't want to be looked at as an old fart, you know.
Yeah. You want to? Well, you have to try and stay relevant one way or another.
Yeah.
That's the challenge, right?
Yeah.
What lured you back into stills photography? You did a thing in Birmingham called People in the City. Mm. Which was possibly the project that took you back into stills photography from the whole film thing.
Well, basically, I wasn't getting anywhere in the film world, to be honest. I don't think it was appropriate for me. It was disappointing. I then had 2 years off writing a feature film, and I ended up pretty broke at the end of it. 2 years off work, wasn't that successful at doing the commercials. And I was offered this project by Rhonda Wilson, you know, to do this Birmingham project, which helped me out of a hole, really.
Yeah.
And got me back. Because I was pretty, pretty down and desperate about that time. Because I thought, well, I've been out of the game 12 years or something. People have forgotten about me.
Right, right. Did you feel like it was going to be a sort of uphill struggle to get back in?
Which it has been, to a certain extent. It has been for a number of years. It's not so much now, but it's taken quite a number of years to really get on the radar of the art world of photography.
Yeah. So, but you've got a sort of never give up, never quit, never surrender kind of mentality, haven't you?
I have, yeah.
Have you always had that?
Yeah, always. I got to. I mean, photography doesn't lend itself to being a little bit lackadaisical. It just doesn't work.
So you've got to keep going.
You've got to give it all to really produce something interesting. And I see that with a lot of young photographers. They don't give it all, really. They give it something, but not all.
Right.
Well, maybe they're not talented enough. I don't know. But
or determined, maybe. I mean, maybe it's not so much about determined as about talent as about persistence and, you know, all
those
things.
You've got to be totally obsessed. I can't tell you the dedication you need to have. And you've got to face problems that probably exist in your life, you know, and just not worry about them, you know, whether you've got financial problems, personal problems. You've got to wipe the floor of them, got to get them out of the way and carry on with your photography. Because also, like the negative side of life actually produces some really interesting work
from
you, you know.
Yeah, I was talking to David Alan Harvey for the podcast fairly recently, and he was saying, you know, that, you know, art comes from the, you know, the grit and the struggle and the pain and the misery. You know, that's where the good stuff comes from.
He's very successful.
Yeah, but I guess you agree with that, generally speaking.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, most definitely.
So, what is the secret to your career longevity then? Just that whole sort of obsessiveness and that never stop.
It's like the fact that I've got so much material now, you know, from my whole career, which is, as I said earlier, 45 years. I can pull on so much of different, whether it's a portrait, a band, a still life, whatever it is. I've got so much material. And that will focus people's attention as an income sideline for me, you know, and not leave me barren. You know, when like a job is going to help me survive, type of thing. I'll probably survive from, you know, exhibitions or talks or books I do, you know. That's what I feel. I'm a bit like a musician of today, you know. No longer are they the Elton Johns, you know, with their millzillions, you know. They're all on 50 odd grand, the musicians.
Yeah, that's it, isn't it? It's interesting when
it's
you talk to
download and everything.
Yeah, it's like being
you've
a kind of
be an artist, you've got to really suffer.
If you're quite a successful musician these days, it might mean you're earning, you know, sort of 40 grand a year, like Joe Schmo, who's got a kind of 9 to 5. You know, that's, but you get to do something cool and interesting and something you love.
Yeah.
But you're not going to be, like you say, Elton John. You're not going to make a million. Or more. But you know the 2000s have been, you've probably been busier than ever to some extent. You did the St. Pancras thing, which we talked about. You did the Olympic project, you know, you had that big exhibition in Arles, I think you said. You even did a film for Paul McCartney when you were still
I did the New Library of Birmingham as well, of course. Reference works. So I've done the major corporate projects in this country this century, or been part of them, so I should feel rather proud, you know, that I do get asked to do them. I don't know, though, there has been an erosion of people's focus towards photography these days, with it being so predominantly everywhere and an ease of executing it. It's actually had an erosive effect upon sincere and good photography, I think, where people don't recognize good, sincere photography anymore.
Yeah.
Just recognize fact.
What mistakes do you see young photographers making repeatedly?
Well, a lot of the ones I've worked with is that they fall into the category of doing the come-to-run professional work because they've got to make a living. And it seems that most of the living around these days is doing like someone handing a credit card over to a receptionist at a hotel or being welcomed at your seat on a British Airways flight, first class or something.
Yeah.
That seems to be a lot of the stuff now. And they don't necessarily need to use a very good photographer to do that, because all the equipment does it for the photographer.
Yeah, so they're not developing their own sort of personal
vision. It's very little of it. I think there's a bit in fashion photography, probably. Probably one of the last remaining bastions of it. It's interesting. A magazine phoned me up yesterday, and I said, it's one of those out twice a year. I went, here we go. Do it for nothing, you know. I do so many of those for nothing. He said, oh, no, we pay. And I went, oh. I was really shocked. I mean, there's so much work in photography around at the moment in the more creative zones that you have to do for free.
Yeah, I know. But you're still passionate and motivated as ever by the sound of things. You know, it's sort of
part, I am, yeah, part of who I'm you interested are. In finding out about myself. A lot of people my age throttle back and don't really go for it. I'm interested to see what happens in the latter part of my life, really. Because I've had some friends declare that they've lost it, you know, around my age group. I won't mention it, but it was in some of the magazines they mentioned it publicly, that they don't do it anymore, or they can't get on top of it, they can't really produce the work they used to. They feel the talent is gone, you know.
And you don't want to find yourself in that position.
I don't know. I mean, I might through necessity, I might something go wrong with me or something. But I'm going to keep on going. So I think, I don't know, age is just a number, they say, don't they? That's what they
it's
say.
It's true.
But the brain's got to work with photography, and the brain has to work really well.
Yeah. So we've all got to deal with that kind of, you know, inevitable mental decline. But then, you know, I guess your experience then compensates in some respect, or, you know, just your...
Yeah, I mean, being bloody-minded, essentially. I can't give you young students and young photographers enough advice to be bloody-minded. Like, get on with your work, because that's what's going to keep you alive when you reach later age, like me. If you don't do great work when you're, you know, working hard and young, what have you got to live on, you know, when you get really old?
Yeah.
Unless, of course, you become incredibly rich, of course.
Well, I don't know, yeah. Some people don't get successful until they're relatively old, but I think that's probably quite uncommon, I think, yeah. It is.
Painters do get successful when they get really old. It was quite good when I looked at the abstract American abstract expressionist, Philip Guston. He got really famous with his latest work when he was 70.
Right.
Gives you faith, really.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that my new project on the First World War is going to be really good.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, what happened was that I went to see my friend Chris Killip, his exhibition in Manhattan at the Yossi Milo Gallery. And really beautiful prints and things. So I thought I would go up to the gallery assistant or gallerist, whatever, and say, Chris is one of my good old friends. We'd known each other since the 70s, I suppose. And I said, would you tell him that I've got a show around the corner? I'd like him to go and see it at the Stephen Kasher Gallery. He says, this was last February, so February 2016. And she said, yes, I will. And I gave her a card with my email, and she did. And I said, oh, by the way, how much is that one over there behind her? Because I've got that one.
Right, you got that print.
Vintage. She said $12,000. I went, oh, thanks, Chris, I love you. yeah. But anyway, he quoted me in Time magazine about his Il Fragrante 2, his reprint. And said Brian Griffin thought it was awful, Il Fragrante 1, because a lot of photographs went across the bleed. And he quoted me in Time magazine. And then he corrected that in Il Fragrante 2. None of them go across the bleed. I don't think they do. I've got it. I don't think they do.
Okay, yeah.
And anyway, this gallerist, this young French woman, late 20s, got in touch with me about 6-9 months later. And said, I'd like to commission you for an exhibition in Béthune, northern France, and you to have a retrospective in this arts centre, as well as new work and a book published in England and in Paris or in France. I went, wow, that's fantastic. Of course, I'd love to. And so She said, can you think about what you're going to do? And it's obvious 2018 is going to be a 100-year celebration, I'd like to say, of the end of the most horrific war on Earth. And my show opens, it's on for 3 months, opens in March next year. So I started to think about how to go about the photography in it. And you know, really conceptual now, I've gone really, really heavily. Because they didn't give me any of the budget. I first went over there last October. And they didn't like pay me any money towards making the material. I'd gone a few £1,000s into my own personal pocket. And they only paid me last week, since October last year. So I shall go over to France now, of course. But what it did, it inspired me to think of ideas in this country, because we were in the First World War, like the French were, like the Germans were, and like 71 countries of the world were, whatever. So I've started doing work over here. And it's based, the work is based upon certain things about the First World War, and I use my friends as the models and things.
Great. Is it, so are you shooting, is it in the studio or are you shooting on location?
I will shoot in the studio and on the location I've shot, yeah.
Oh, cool.
I've shot a little bit in France. I went to the McCainov and Chips factory because my exhibition, I don't know whether they're going to accept this, I'm going to tell them this what it's going to be. I'm titling it Spud. Now, Spud, there's probably a few soldiers called Spud. It's a nickname, Spud.
Yeah, yeah.
For soldiers, definitely at that period of time. And I went to, I found another factory that, the McCain Oven Chips factory was in Beethoven. And the potatoes come out of the battlefield earth. So all the skeletons, all the organs, all the blood, everything that went into the soil is actually producing potatoes for McCain Oven Chips.
Right, interesting.
So there's a section in my in my project on McCain Oven Chips.
Brilliant. Look forward to seeing it, Brian, when it finally comes to light.
It'll be as mad as ever. Well, going all the way back to the Black Country days where it's madness living there, you know.
Yeah,
I haven't
yeah.
lost it.
Keep at it, and it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for making the time to chat, and it's you know, it's real
my pleasure.
Privilege.
I've enjoyed it. You've asked some really poignant questions.
Well, thanks.
One was really difficult. I can't remember which one, but I mentioned it. It's really difficult.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. I try. I'm still learning. You know, it's still part of my learning curve. Doing this, but I'm enjoying it, and it's been a pleasure. So, thank you so much.